Well, we're continuing on in Mark chapter 6. We'll look at the last, is that about 12 verses? And so we are covering Mark chapter 6, verses 45 through 56. And I've titled this one, Loaves to Stones. And you will see why as we go on. So this section consists of two parts. The first part is another story of the disciples out on the sea in a storm. And although it may seem like a separate story from the feeding of the 5,000, it's really a continuation, at least in Mark's literary form. The two parts are tied by the use of the loaves and the fish, and we'll see loaves appearing again. And then, following that, there's going to be a second part, and this second part is a summary text of Jesus and his disciples' most recent mission. It also acts as a transition to the next set of texts. So, in regards to the loaves, this is what a commentary has to say. Mark ties this incident closely to the preceding account of the feeding of the 5,000 by noting in verse 52 that the disciples' fearful collapse here was caused by their failure to understand that the feeding miracle revealed Jesus' true significance and power. Since Mark thus ties together these two incidents, it is likely that he wants his reader to see them both as complementary revelations of Jesus. This means that the sea miracle is another manifestation of the divine significance of Jesus' person and not just a miracle story. Some of the themes.
Oh, I see. At the end of the storm story, it says, for they did not understand about the loaves. So here he's tying the storm story back to the loaves and fishes.
Right.
Okay.
Some of the unifying themes that we find here are the question, who is Jesus, although not directly asked, is kind of at the background. Another theme is faith and unbelief, and a third theme may be the parable of the sower and seeds that comes back in some of the imagery and the words that are used. So the first part, verses 45 through 52, is the story of the storm. Immediately he made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, to Bethsaida, while he dismissed the crowd. And after he had taken leave of them, he went up on the mountain to pray. And when evening came, the boat was out on the sea, and he was alone on the land. And he saw that they were making headway painfully, for the wind was against them. And about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them, walking on the sea. He meant to pass by them. But when they saw him walking on the sea, they thought it was a ghost, and cried out, for they all saw him and were terrified. But immediately he spoke to them and said, take heart, it is I, do not be afraid. And he got into the boat with them, and the wind ceased. And they were utterly astounded, for they did not understand about loaves, but their hearts were hardened. So, immediately preceding, the large crowd has had their physical needs met. The miracle of the feeding, at least in Mark, is only known to the disciples. But maybe the crowd has some questions and they suspect some answers. It is now late afternoon, probably. The crowd will have to begin their journeys home now or camp here for the night. So, before we go into some of the discussion points and questions, anything you notice about the text? Any observations, any comments? Anything you see that might be a little odd?
Mm-hmm. your standard walking on the water story that we've always heard, except this one doesn't have Peter getting out of the boat.
Okay. The omission of Peter.
Uh-huh.
Peter is only found in Matthew.
Uh-huh.
It sounds like he wants to get to the other side of the lake, so he's walking across it.
Okay. He's just walking across because he has a destination to go to.
Well, yeah, why did he...
It doesn't like going around, so it goes over it.
He meant to pass by
him. Yeah, why did he send them ahead of him without going in the boat himself?
Okay.
I mean, that seems odd. Unless the purpose of it was to walk to them on the water and make them say, wow.
All right, so what reasons might Jesus have had for sending the disciples away so abruptly in the boat and while Jesus goes to pray?
Needed some time alone.
Okay, that would be a somewhat obvious, obvious reason.
Especially after the last story, when they had gone away to get some time alone and the crowd followed.
He might have been just sparing the disciples the chance to muck it up again by having to talk to the people, having any chance to keep his secret of the miracle or not.
Okay.
Letting them.
All right.
Yeah. No. He wanted them to leave right away because they were the only ones that knew about the bread.
Okay.
And to keep them from intermingling and somehow saying, well, we don't know what, you know.
Or for whatever reason, he wanted to prevent them.
He wanted to prevent the two sides from interacting.
Yeah, basically. after that was over. Interesting. Yeah.
In the Gospel according to John, the crowd are aware of the miracle and this sign that has happened. And in that gospel account, the crowds are buzzing with this messianic kingdom. So they want to crown Jesus king.
Yeah.
And the disciples are being swept up in it.
And in the Gospel of Mark, at least, that sort of thing never turns out well. In all the Gospels, that messianic fervor never turns out.
So in the Gospel of John, the clear reason, according to John, is that Jesus doesn't want that to happen. And so he sends the disciples away, disperses the crowd, and he goes away by himself. Now, Mark doesn't have that. He leaves kind of the reason ambiguous.
But he still could definitely have been preventing that from happening by dispersing.
Yeah, so here's a couple things that the commentaries have to say. The abruptness with which Jesus constrained the disciples to return to their boat and directed them to Bethsaida, Julius, in the territory of Herod Philip, suggests a crisis which is unexplained in the Markan narrative. The wilderness plays a prominent role, however, in the several messianic uprisings of the first century, and in John chapter 6, verse 14 states that the people recognized Jesus as the promised eschatological prophet and determined to proclaim him king. The tension of messianic excitement was dangerously in the air after the meal in the desert. The hurried dismissal of the disciples prevented them from adding fuel to the fire by revealing to the people the miraculous character of the evening meal. Jesus remained to pacify and dismiss the unruly crowd. This analysis is confirmed when the reference to Jesus in prayer is seen in the context of Mark's structure. In each case when Jesus goes to prayer, it is night, and Jesus finds himself in a moment of crisis prompted by the enthusiasm of the crowds or the impending passion. And another commentary reads, going to the other side, in Mark's language, means going to Gentile territory. It means going to the unknown, going to the foreign, going to the other side of humanity. No wonder the disciples were made, or as the Greek word more strongly suggests, forced to go. So Bethsaida is located at the north end of the Sea of Galilee on the east side, the Gentile side. The Jordan River comes in on the north and exits the south. Bethsaida is on the east bank where the Jordan enters the Sea of Galilee. On the west side, not too far, on the other side of the Jordan is Capernaum.
So again, this is their hearts are hardened and they didn't understand the loaves. When Jesus meant to pass them, he meant to pass people that understood him. He meant to pass people that understood mm-hmm. what had just happened, mm-hmm. why it had just happened, and where they were going and why they were being sent there, and him sending them on their own and then preceding them by walking past them on water should have been an indication that, well, our leader and savior is leading the way for us and passing us and leading the way. We should have no fear at this point in time and we should be
just following.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But instead they lost it
scared.
And they, you know, couldn't handle seeing him go by,
because
and so their hearts
didn't
are hard.
Get it about the loaves.
They didn't get it about the loaves.
I never noticed that he meant to pass by them. I always thought that he walked out to them.
Well,
yeah.
Maybe in the other,
yeah, I'm
maybe
sure
in John's text, mm-hmm. it was different, but
yeah.
Or
and the one we usually hear is the one with Peter in it,
yeah.
where Peter says, if you're really you, tell me to come to mm-hmm. you, and I'll walk on the water too.
Well, in this one, he's clearly saying that. Again, in a same situation where he's been told that, where he's given them the chance
right.
to learn on their own.
And this is the second time the disciples are out in the sea in a storm. Mm-hmm. The first time Jesus was already in the boat.
He was sleeping. Yeah.
Right.
This time Jesus is not in the boat, but he approaches them.
Well, he wasn't even approaching him. It was more like they noticed he was going by.
Yeah.
He's just going
by. Instead of noticing the direction
that
he's going.
They had the opportunity to recognize and follow.
Yeah.
And instead they panicked.
Okay.
Because they were on the sea, which for them was an evil place.
Mm-hmm.
And they saw a figure going by, assumed it was a ghost.
Yeah, kind
of
weird.
So when Jesus prays, it is often away from the crowds. This is the second time that the Mark and Jesus withdraws for private prayer. The first time happened in chapter 1, verse 35. The portrayal of Jesus as a person of prayer establishes his dependence upon God and contributes to the defense of Jesus and the Christian miracle workers against the charge of practicing magic. When Apollonius of Tyana was accused of practicing magic because he had successfully stopped a plague at Ephesus, he defended himself by explaining that he had merely prayed to Hercules to stop the plague. A magician conjures the gods with spells, but a religious person entreats them with prayers. This distinction may look like hair splitting to Mark's modern readers, but an ancient audience would have recognized it as a legitimate defense.
Mm-hmm. Asking the gods to intervene rather than controlling the gods.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And once more, in the Synoptic Gospels, Jesus is portrayed as much more human than he is divine. It's only in John's gospel account that that Jesus is truly portrayed as divine.
So why were they so utterly astounded that when Jesus got in the boat, the wind stopped?
Well,
why? Why is it that they're so utterly astounded? Take heart, it is I, do not be afraid. And he got into the boat with them, and the wind ceased. They were utterly astounded. What is that supposed to mean? Why are they so...
Because they didn't yet truly believe that he was who he was.
Yeah, it's probably some of it.
Well, and the previous story...
See, remember, it's who is Jesus is kind of the question that is behind all of these stories now, starting with Herod and the Mark and John the Baptist being executed.
Yeah, this whole series of
and it's going to end in chapter 8 with Jesus finally asking his disciples directly, who am I?
In the previous storm story, he calmed the storm and they were amazed. But I don't remember.
One of the things we noted at the very towards the very beginning of this whole study in Mark is that amazement is generally not a good thing in
right.
Mark's gospel.
Right.
Amazement is an expression of unbelief.
Well, generally the crowds are amazed, and it's more like if you're watching a magic show and you say wow, and that's not an expression of faith and following.
So let's take a look at the sequence.
It's more like, wow, what's the trick?
Yeah. So Jesus sends away the disciples and disperses the crowds. He goes up into the mountain to pray. And then Jesus sees the disciples struggling in the middle of the night in the storm. Then Jesus goes to them at the fourth watch, which is near dawn, and walks on the water. Jesus does not immediately go out to rescue the disciples. Why might that be? He seems to wait a long time, watching the disciples struggle.
Because they're supposed to be...
figuring out who he is.
Yeah. They're not supposed to be struggling. They're supposed to be just doing it because they know that... because he told them to, and so... so just go do it.
Well, you're going to struggle. It's rough weather. It's dark. You don't have any way of knowing where you're going. It's not that you're not going to struggle. It's that you're not going to struggle with fear as to whether or not you're going to be fine.
Maybe they were more than just struggling. Maybe they were just completely losing it.
It's more like you're sitting there second-guessing whether or not you have the competent skills and are given the will and strength to make it through what you're doing. Because you're going to... The job's not going to be easy one way or the other.
Yeah.
It's whether your competency and attitude toward the job are going to be positive and capable. And so what... it's just the same rhetoric. It's just if they were... if they had believed that Christ would not send them into anything that they wouldn't be able to handle in the first place, their idea of being out on the water in the middle of the night, going toward this unknown place, would be a no-brainer because they're like, hey, God told us to do it. Let's go.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what he's waiting for, is for them to come to that realization on their own. Or he's just, you know...
and maybe waiting for them to see him there and follow him.
But the hour of dawn is important, too, because that's everything, I don't know.
Well, what's the saying? It's darkest at dawn, darkest near dawn.
Darkest before the dawn, but at the same time, that's when everybody, I mean, almost anything you're doing, you seem to struggle almost all the way to the bitter point of it's, you can't handle it anymore, and then most people die right before they get to this spot where they would have made it, because they lose it. And or not die, I shouldn't say, but they've missed their chance to have the glory of making it to the end of something because they give up before. And everything is scarier at night. Everything is way, way worse at night. It's slower, it's unknown, you don't know where things are coming from. But I mean, the second that the second any light, that gray light hits where you can actually see further than the next thing, everything seems completely different. And I'm sure he was waiting to hear them say that to each other. This is the hour of
revelation
is upon us. You know what I mean? We're going to be just fine. We got an hour and 20 minutes. We've been out here for 7 hours in the dark. Give it another hour, it's going to be just fine. We'll be able to see where we're going or whatever.
Well, and the audience of this gospel are Roman Christians who are being possibly persecuted. They're at least being oppressed for following Christ, for doing what Jesus has asked them to do, at least in their minds. So what is...
Keep following, and Don will be here soon.
Well, we're also looking at this in the regard that these people have been around Jesus for long enough at a time when the readers have all but lost every trace of the generations that even knew or heard of or were around Christ when he was alive. But these are people that were standing right next to him losing faith. Mm-hmm. And so it's trying, by the time we get to the end of this story, you're going to see that these people were given that faith or whatever. But it's important for people to read it that way and understand that even the people that this is trying to give comfort to in the future have to realize that the guys that were standing right next to him were sitting around going,
didn't get it either.
I don't know about this guy yet, He's only turning water into wine and, taking care of everybody and doing all this crazy stuff. But I'm just not sure yet,
So what can be said of the contrast between the disciples struggling and Jesus walking on water? There's the water is the same. The wind is the same. Mm-hmm. The disciples are struggling.
That's just because Christ... they said he had his little prayer, right?
Yeah. He had his prayer.
He knew where he was going. I guess that's the contrast to that, is that Christ's faith in God to send him where he needed to go and do what he was supposed to is the contrast between the two characters. Because the disciples aren't individual characters at this point in time. They're a singular character, and Christ is another singular character. And the situations around them are the antagonists of the story. Mm-hmm. So when you say disciples, you actually are just kind of general. That's a character of the story, not...
They're a collective character.
Right. They're not an individual groups of people with names and numbers to them. They're just...
In the other storm story, it was like the storm was itself one of the characters in the story. Mm-hmm. The storm was the demon working against you.
Well, that's what I was saying, is that each situation of the disciples... are finding themselves in are actual they're antagonists of the story. They're Christ and the disciples are the characters of the story. When Christ stops to pray, that's another, it's not necessarily, it's almost a character itself or a part of the story.
Well, and that's what I was saying. I was building on what you said. And when Jesus walks on the water, he's demonstrating that he has overcome already. It's done.
Yeah.
There's nothing else to worry about. You can just have confidence and know that the overcoming is accomplished. Especially for the Roman Christians that are reading this, they do know that the overcoming has been accomplished at the cross. and the resurrection. And so they can see Christ's confidence and know that he has overcome. And you can trust in that.
But he always has to go back. I think the prayer part is important because Christ has to stop and
oh,
get
yeah.
direction also. And I think that's what the disciples are missing, is that they are missing their opportunity to take direction, to take the word of somebody else and be faithful in it and say, okay, yeah, this guy's right. Let's do what this guy says we're supposed to do. Because obviously Christ didn't just take care of all this by himself. He didn't just come to earth and take everybody and say, yeah, this is going to be the way it is, and then be put on the cross and resurrected all by himself. He had faith in the fact that God was putting him here for reasons that he was here. Anyways.
And, yes, you can have that same thing.
So we get to the phrase, he meant to pass by them.
Okay.
We kind of talked about what we think it might have meant. So here is what one commentary has to say about it. It soon becomes apparent, however, that without Jesus' leadership, the disciples are not going to make it to Gentile territory. Again, they are meeting with opposition, as in chapter 4, verses 35 through 41. Seeing this, the Markan Jesus again demonstrates his superiority over the hostile sea power by striding across the sea, an activity attributed to God in Job chapter 9, verse 8, and Isaiah chapter 43, verse 16. His intent was to walk ahead of them, to lead them, like a good shepherd, to their destination. However, the disciples do not recognize him and cry out in fear. Now remember that in the introduction to the feeding of the 5,000 story, Jesus saw the masses around him as sheep without a shepherd. And from that, we are to take, the readers of Mark are to see that Jesus is the shepherd, the genuine shepherd. And so that imagery continues here. God striding across the sea in the Old Testament is an activity that only gods can do, and specifically for the Hebrews, their God. Now, it is a demonstration of subjugation of the chaos, as in the creation account in Genesis 1. The spirit hovering over the waters. God can control the chaos. God can control the storm. So, that's kind of what is probably meant by to pass by them. His intent, as we've discussed, was not to get into the boat with them. He was going to go ahead of them to lead them over to their destination.
He knows that he's not always going to be with them in the boat or whatever. He's not always going to be right there with them, and he wants them to be able to follow. He wants to lead them.
Probably wants to go further than that, in the fact that he's doing this with 12 people. Supposedly. A small group.
12-ish. Yeah.
And he just fed 5,000.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got to get 12 of these people to think as closely as he is thinking and acting, so that those 12 might be able to maybe make 12 more.
Yeah.
Because what he's saying here is, what's happening here is that you're basically instead of having the whole world walking around with him all the time so that they can all see this, he's dismissing these large crowds and making these large points try to go away. He doesn't want the whole world to think he's the king.
Mm-hmm.
He wants the whole world to think each other capable of giving each other this will and this this appreciation for God to be able to give that gift from one human to another. Because if he just walked around and did all this all the time, well, then everybody would have no ability to give that gift to somebody else. So this discipleship part of this is so ridiculously important in these stories, because this is beyond just Christ trying to show the world that he's the person that he is. This is he's trying to show these individual people as much of himself as he can, so that they can have the same confidence that he does to
he's
carry
trying
out
to create in these people what he wants for the world. And they're not getting it.
It's not that they're not getting it. It's that it's so it'd be like some little league kid going up to play T-ball for the first time ever, and having like who's the greatest, you know, having Barry Bonds or some great baseball player come up to you and say, I'm going to take you and train you to be the best ball player you ever were and ever could be. And then leaving him in a major league fastball coming at him at, you know, 90 miles an hour. And it's a slip curve ball, and the kid, and he's like, don't worry, you're going to hit it. You know? And that's basically what the contrast in our modern thinking would be. It would be like that. It would be like, here's this guy that literally... It, in a way, you have to take a little bit to these disciples and say, well, you can't be too mad at them.
Oh, no.
Because,
I mean,
you can't be too hard on these guys, because it's,
well,
I mean, it's like...
What would we have been in this situation? I mean...
You know, you're basically being groomed in the responsibility of being able to take this image to the person next to you is a great responsibility in itself, and maybe the kid just wanted to hit the T-ball. He wasn't ready for it. Like, my goodness, really? I'm supposed to be this person that's going to give your gift to the next million people I might meet in my life?
And the picture that he was describing was so countercultural. It didn't make sense. And he keeps saying it in different ways, but it's still so against what they're expecting in their culture.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make sense to them until after the cross, after the resurrection. Then it all makes sense. Then they're able to put it together.
Well, I guess I was answering part of that question down below there without reading a little bit.
Now, what about Jesus causes the disciples to fear?
The unexpectedness of them being there?
Well, that's kind of what I was saying. Is they have...
It was a ghost.
A ghost.
They have...
The disciples reacted to Jesus' appearance with terror, convinced that they had encountered a water spirit. The popular belief that spirits of the night brought disaster is illustrated by a tradition preserved in the Talmud. Rabbah said, "Seafarers told me that the wave that sinks a ship appears with a white fringe of fire at its crest, and when stricken with clubs on which is engraven, 'I am that I am, Yah the Lord of hosts, Amen, Amen, Selah,' it subsides." So here's a magical ritual to subjugate water spirits.
Yeah.
Now that's the tradition, the folklore, the kind of the mythical mysticism that the disciples are living in.
And that's not some pagan thing. That's part of
this is part of Jewish folklore.
Right.
Uh-huh.
That's what I'm saying is these guys are put in a position where they're basically out of their league, man.
Right.
They have no idea the compounding effects of what their whole life that is before them is going to set up for centuries to come.
Yeah, yeah. But after the cross and the resurrection, they do figure it out, and they discover who this person really was that they've been walking around with. They gradually start to figure it out.
So it's
but
their...
it's not till later that they really understand.
So their cultural ideology at this time is what causes them to fear him?
Yeah. All of the ancients believed that some kind of supernatural controlled everything.
Yeah.
Now, the Jews, being monotheistic, could not attribute everything to gods, but they did the next best thing. They had angels and demons and spirits controlling everything. Which is kind of a polytheism without technically being polytheistic.
You've got sub-gods within the big one.
Yeah. So we've noted that what's missing in Mark is Peter asking to walk on the water, which is interesting because, according to tradition, Mark's gospel is based on Peter's recollections.
Oh. Weird.
So, it's maybe just Peter being very humble about, or being embarrassed about his failure.
I just leave that bit out. That was a
and in any case, from a theological literary perspective, it would distract from Mark's point that he's trying to make.
Yeah.
What significant concepts is Jesus communicating through his words? Take heart, it is I, do not be afraid. It seems like a fairly innocuous statement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's kind of the heart of this part of the story.
Does it mean something more?
It reveals a whole lot more.
Hmm.
Continuing the imagery of the new Exodus, the narrator has Jesus identify himself with the self-designation of Yahweh, I am. Thus, the author of Mark provides the audience with a definitive answer to the question raised by the disciples in the previous sea rescue story. Who then is this? The promise of deliverance is reinforced by an echo of Deutero-Isaiah's "Don't be afraid." Sadly, none of this provides clarification for the disciples, who remain utterly astounded. So Jesus... is, according to Mark, fulfilling or alluding to certain prophetic utterances that reveal who he is.
Does he use other I am phrases?
What was the little chant that they were supposed to chant before the wave hit him?
I am
that I am. Yah, the Lord of hosts. Amen, amen. Selah.
And in the midst of this storm, he they're asking the God of their world to stop the wave. Right? That's what they're saying. Like, the God of God,
right,
please stop this wave.
Well, and
about
God,
to hit me. And so, basically, they're standing in front of a cresting wave, and the wave is telling them that I'm God, and just calm down, and they're not getting that part
of
it.
And
then the wave hits the boat.
Mm-hmm.
Lands within them and stops everything, and they're still just like, did that really happen? Am I asleep on the shore somewhere wondering if this is real?
Pretty normal.
Yeah.
That would be normal for anybody that's in a position where they're, they're being...
It was a normal response.
Well, and it's important to remember that the Jews did not expect the Messiah to be divine.
And God's identification of himself, he says, I am. And that's how God identifies himself.
What do you mean by didn't expect their Messiah to be divine?
The prophecies, none of the prophecies could be taken to point to this promised anointed one.
There was going
to be God himself.
One.
The Messiah would be an agent of God.
But they weren't expecting God himself.
They weren't expecting God himself.
So they were waiting for another Moses.
For another Elijah, like the Old Testament prophets, and a king like David.
Much less an ordinary looking guy who is actually God himself. They didn't expect the Messiah to be more important looking and sounding.
And also,
the
Jews are being influenced by Greek thought, in which the Greek deities are very aloof. You know, they do not come to the earth, it's a very bad thing.
Right. It's always to take advantage of the people.
To, like, break the women and cause storms and argue with each other, and the people end up in the middle, and the people get destroyed as a side effect of the gods arguing or something.
Yeah, the ancients did live in fear of everything. They had rituals and incantations and charms and things to try to secure their lives.
Worse than we are. I don't really know that our knowledge has made us any better at being less afraid of everything, though.
It's a different way and a different thing. Or maybe.
It's not even a different way, and it's not even really any different things. People are still completely and 100% afraid of unknown, and they're completely 100% gullible to anybody and anything that will explain to them the unknown in a way that they're. Cultural mindset.
So even if they had an inkling of an idea that this was God, it would have been more like, what did we get ourselves mixed up with?
that could be.
Yeah, when's the price part of this coming into effect here, guys? Because Greek gods always had a price. Everything cost something to do business with the gods. Mm-hmm. Period. Whether you were just thought you were being friends with them or anything.
Yeah.
It costs.
Well, an ordinary looking guy showing up and claiming to be the Messiah was countercultural enough. Mm-hmm. But an ordinary looking guy claiming to be not only the Messiah, but God, that was a little much.
Yeah, so Jesus gets into the boat. The wind ceases. The disciples are amazed. However, Mark writes that this amazement is due to the disciples not understanding about the loaves. So what is Mark saying about Jesus and his disciples at this point? Now, this amazement is due to unbelief. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It is worse yet, the narrator informs the audience that like Jesus' opponents and those outside, their hearts have been hardened. Despite their having been chosen and sent out on a successful mission, despite their having just participated in Jesus' own miraculous ministry, the disciples seem to be in danger of becoming outsiders. Mark alone explains that they had failed to understand about the loaves and that their hearts were hardened. The disciples certainly realized that the multitude had been fed with 5 loaves and 2 fish, but they had failed to grasp that this event pointed beyond itself to the secret of Jesus' person. Because they were not truly open to the action of God in Jesus, they had missed the significance of the miracle of the loaves for them, and saw only a marvel. That is why they displayed not confidence and joy in Jesus' unexpected presence, but faithless panic. And finally, in this story, the disciples do not understand that Jesus himself is the metaphorical key to the feeding miracle. He is the bread of life sitting in a boat with them.
Mm-hmm. Is that why you left them out there so long? You're not paying attention.
Well, when they saw the miraculous feeding, they probably thought, oh, this is going to be a really useful thing for when we come into our own. We'll be able to feed an army easy, and we can really get some things accomplished here. But they didn't realize what it actually meant. They didn't realize the bread of life. I am God, here to meet all of your needs, emotional, physical, spiritual.
Yeah, so here's how the Complete Jewish Bible translates verse 52. For they did not understand about the loaves. On the contrary, their hearts had been made stone-like. How might this relate to the parables of chapter 4?
Oh,
it's the parable the seeds. Of the sower and the soil and the seeds.
The seeds. They were rocky ground.
Rocky ground.
Interesting.
And, you know, the idea that hearts were hardened is a phrase that's used in the Old Testament, for example, Pharaoh.
Yeah.
Now, in tracing this lack of understanding to hardness of heart, Mark indicates that at this stage in Jesus' ministry, the disciples are not essentially different from his opponents, who also fail to recognize his unique character and exhibit hardness of heart. Finally, although Mark does not include the specifics of Jesus' temptation in the wilderness, and I might be reading more into this text than is there, I find it interesting that this loaves stone pair is found here. So what might be its message? Jesus was in Matthew and Luke where the details of his temptation are recorded. One of the temptations is for Jesus to turn these stones into loaves of bread.
Well, yeah. Jesus is trying to turn stones into bread. Metaphorically, he's trying to create life and healing and love where there was none before.
It's interesting because, you know, that the three temptations could be are shown to be very literal at the temptation, but they point towards something that is more perhaps metaphorical, and maybe that we haven't really thought. At least I haven't heard of too many discussions, actually none, to be truly accurate, where that stones to bread is treated metaphorically. You know, the idea of ruling the world, or
he wants the stones to turn themselves to bread.
Well, he is the agent that turns the stones into bread, but not literally. You know, so maybe those that temptation story is pointing to a greater ministry, the overall ministry of Jesus, just not the way in which the devil or Satan wanted him to do it.
Well, right, because he stood on the hill and said, well, you can just turn them all into your believers, which he could. And that's why they go so great lengths to diminish all of these great miracle and acts, because if God wanted to, why wouldn't he just step down and be like, see what I did? I'm great, thanks a lot, everybody, have a good day, I'm going to go back up here and you're all going to worship me.
But rather than just turning all the stones into bread, turning all the unbelievers into believers, he wants to love them and convince them one at a time. And show them what his idea
was. He did a little more than one at a time. He took a small group.
Well, but rather than just zapping them all, he wants to show them what his ideal world.
He wants us to choose it.
Yeah.
I heard a sermon on discipleship.
But turning stones into bread his own way.
I heard a sermon about discipleship and what the numbers people are talking about, numbers for churches, and we need numbers for churches, but this was more of a number of good people for your churches, where instead of going after
it's quality over quantity.
Yeah, and how the effect of one quality believer in Christ has toward the effect of Christ word being propagated throughout eternity, and it has to do with the fact that basically you're never going to get a major metropolitan area to be. If you do, there's going to be something wrong with it, and you're really your only bet is to take all opportunity to find the people that want to listen the most.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
The few that want to listen the most.
If you get 100 people to say the words, is that really a benefit?
They might not even get
what they're saying. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. As opposed to helping one person to transform their life
and actually
become a new person and change their little part of the world.
So we get to the last part of chapter 6. Healing but no teaching. Verses 53 through the end. When they had crossed over, they came to the land at Gennesaret and moored to the shore. When they got out of the boat, the people immediately recognized him and ran about the whole region and began to bring the sick people on their beds to wherever they heard he was. And wherever he came, in villages, cities, or countryside, they laid the sick in the marketplaces and implored him that they might touch even the fringe of his garment. And as many as touched it were made well. These verses act as a summary of ministry events that came earlier and is a transition to the next set of stories. The very next section deals with the topic of ritual purity. And so how does this tie into the next section? Here's how. The fringe on Jesus' garment probably refers to the blue tassel that Jewish males were expected to have on the corners of their cloaks, which would indicate Jesus' careful observance of Jewish law. A detail that provides a transition to the next episode in Mark's Gospel, a discussion about rabbinic legal traditions with Pharisees and scribes from Jerusalem.
Jewish ritual purity. And they want a little bit of that?
Well,
they want a little bit of what he's got.
So the next story is going to be about the discussion of ritual purity. And then that is followed by a healing of a non-Jewish girl. And then that's followed by Jesus traveling from Jewish territory into Gentile territory, where Jesus feeds the 4,000. And then another boat trip is narrated, in which another question about bread and loaves is raised. A blind man is then given sight in stages, and then Jesus asks his disciples, "Who am I?" So that's kind of the brief outline of what is going to happen after this section. Let's see, what is this?
Is "Who am I" still the overarching question?
"Who am I" is, through these stories, Mark is developing the answer.
Is "Who am I" the question of the whole book?
Yeah. Mark opened the very first verses. This is the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God.
Uh-huh. Well, he's got to get into this sometime because basically when it reminded me that when he said that the Jewish people didn't expect a divine prophet or didn't expect God himself to come visit them again, the Jewish people have always been... every time, they always want a king again. Mm-hmm. They always want a ruler. They always want somebody that's going to lay down the rules and tell them how everything's supposed to be.
And get rid of the people they don't like.
And so, again, this is just one more part in the whole thing where he's having to constantly go to these people and say, "Look, you're not getting, these rules aren't going to happen. You're not, I'm not going to stick around and make sure you all do what you're supposed to be doing. And this little thing that you all, this ladder you guys all want to climb to show that you're on this rung or that run, it doesn't exist." And so, I mean...
Yeah, so, from the feeding of the 5,000 to the storm to this summary, This series of three episodes repeats the pattern seen throughout the gospel in which Jesus' ministry has three components: teaching, healing, and domination of the demonic powers. The pervasive image throughout this series is the Jewish expectation of the eschatological shepherd who will feed, heal, and lead his flock to safety through watery chaos and threatening wilderness. The next section of the gospel redefines religious purity in a way that will mean radical changes in the ethnic makeup of this flock. That's kind of what we have to look forward to. So back to this summary text. Instead of Bethsaida, they end up on the same side as they started, which is the Western Jewish side. And in contrast, the reaction of the disciples on the sea during the night when they see Jesus, when the people see Jesus, they come to Jesus. What is curious about this summary is that, unlike in earlier texts, there is no mention of teaching by Jesus or exorcism, just teaching, just healing. So what does this observation say about the people and about Jesus? And this is another summary account of Jesus' ministry. Only this summary makes no reference to Jesus teaching or exorcising demons, but concentrates on his healings. The attitude of the people is an almost superstitious reverence for Jesus as a wonder worker, including the idea that even his clothing contained healing power. Mark's attitude toward the popular notoriety of Jesus as a wonder worker is that Jesus did indeed do such works, but that the crowd's perception of Jesus was all too shallow and incomplete by the standards of the Christian gospel. And the works of Jesus appear to be an epiphany of divine power, and the people treat him as a miracle worker or divine man whose power is released through touch. In this connection, the absence of any reference to preaching or teaching activity is significant. The people are not prepared for Jesus' proclamation of the word, and the public ministry interrupted in chapter 6, verse 31 has not been resumed. They understand only that power is channeled through his person. Jesus patiently bears with their limited insight and graciously heals those who reach out to him from the bed of affliction.
In the hope that next time he comes around, they can understand.
Possibly. What does the manner of healing reveal about the people's ideas about Jesus? You know, some of the comments already have discussed that, but furthermore, here is how the people thought about disease. Second, this passage invites us to consider the etiology of disease and the mode of healing in antiquity. Ordinary folks in Mark's world assumed that everyone had a personal demon, or a daimonion, that regulated his or her physical and mental health. One usually felt in good spirits. So you now know where that phrase comes from. One usually felt in good spirits and was not even aware of the demon inside. However, every so often that demon could turn temporarily or permanently on its host, or be forced out by the invasion of a bad demon. In that case, the demon's presence was acutely felt and the person became ill. Poultices, herbs, drugs, and other folk remedies could be applied and were sometimes effective. The demon was soothed, and subsequently so was its human host. However, if that did not work, more drastic measures may have been needed. An exorcist could be summoned to apply his or her skills in casting out the evil demon and inviting a benevolent spirit to take its place. So
we hear about guardian angels. Everyone's got their own personal guardian angel. Everybody had their own personal demon too.
Yeah.
Okay then.
So maybe this gives more insight into the idea people had of healing and the process of healing that Jesus accommodated, the thoughts about healing and exercising.
Healing. He is overcoming the demons. He's traveling about overcoming the demons, as evidenced by healing and in general, helping people. Mm-hmm. He's getting rid of their demons.
He's appeasing the demons or driving out the evil ones and replacing it with a benevolent one. That's the idea, the picture people had.
Uh-huh.
It is a very magical thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was nothing behind Jesus other than he was basically another ointment in order to touch him, you could get rid of whatever spirit you...
Yeah, and when we read the Bible, when we strictly keep ourselves to the Bible, we think that only Jesus did these things. But there were many so-called miracle workers, magicians, wonder workers that traveled about. So what Jesus was doing is not necessarily unique, although the way he did it was unique. He didn't have elaborate rituals.
Right.
And he didn't use a whole lot of other things. Now, what's interesting is that in the healing of the blind man that is going to come, it looks almost ritualistic. It's going to be in stages, applying mud.
Same reason why Jesus had to be born of Joseph. Because he's got to fulfill the requirements.
Some of the commentaries note earlier in the gospel is that at the very beginning, Jesus is able to simply speak and perform healings. But towards the end, the descriptions of his healings are far more ritualistic.
Huh. And it's all because he has to placate to his audience in order to get any sort of an inroad into their cultural way of thinking. He can't even... But it's the same thing, though, when we read the story of Jesus' birth, how he had to be adopted by Joseph. He had to be of the family of those men the lineage that he came from, so that his town wouldn't just ostracize him the instant that...
Yeah, and I think what it shows is that the gospel does lead to hardening of hearts. Now, that is to be expected.
Huh.
Now, in some cases, it leads to acceptance. In some cases, it leads to hardening. It's the parable of the soil and the sower and the seeds.
But there's no middle ground. Nobody sees the gospel and has no reaction.
It's one of those love it or hate it things.
Yeah. Well, and even the people that love it, their hearts get hardened in a different way because they feel that they... Now have they're themselves been ostracized out of their own society in which they came from because they can't think or even talk to the people that they used to.
Mm-hmm.
So it has a different effect.
Life is hardened even if your heart isn't.
There's all sorts of different aspects of what happened to you when you change because of the gospel.
Yeah.
Many different ones. Yeah. Some people change thinking that they're changing in a good way with the gospel, and then they become prejudiced of anybody that isn't listening to the gospel.
Yeah.
Some people become hardened against people because they've found something that renewed them and they believe in, but the society around them is diminishing it and taking it away from them, and they're losing their friends from it.
Anytime you change spiritually, people around you may object to that. Especially people you came from, are likely to object to that, have a fit. Life changes and sometimes becomes difficult.
So, as we go into the summary, here's kind of a thought that I had. Christians frequently perform service ministries as an intentional way to open people to literally hearing the gospel, a way to get people to see that Christians aren't all that strange and to get people to be comfortable coming to a church. But is that proper motivation?
I don't think so.
Maybe compassion alone is the only motivation that is proper and necessary. I think that's what Jesus' healing in the very this summary piece shows.
Applying compassion as a strategy.
Yeah. And people feel compassioned. I've been compassioned now. And it's not necessarily a good thing.
No, and quite a few so-called evangelism courses, it's service evangelism is talked about as a way to open people into coming to church.
Right.
Let's bring them water. Let's get them some food. Let's start educating them and giving them the resources to become the humans that they're supposed to be.
And I'm sure that's what Jesus wanted his work to accomplish, that people would become more open to things.
Right.
But that wasn't his motivation.
Nope.
Right. No, our desires and our motivations are not necessarily the same.
Right.
They don't have to be, and they shouldn't be.
That wasn't why he healed people.
But that's the biggest, that's besides the who is God part of things, uh-huh. That's the second biggest thing that people in faith totally struggle with is that the goat's parable, you know, it's well, I fed you, I clothed you, I gave to you. Why am I not part
of now
this? So their service ability, their ability to give Christ to people, they now have to think of that also too. It's not just I've been given Christ. You have to figure out how you got given him, and then you're like, okay, well, I think I got that part down. Now I'm gonna go try to give him to somebody else now. And that's the next part that gets really screwed up.
So continuing on here, the disciples expected Jesus to look one particular way. They've been traveling with him, etc. They know what Jesus looks like. When they saw him walking on the sea, it was unexpected, leading to fear. What lesson might this have for us? So the commentary reads, their failure of theological imagination is complete. Rather than understanding the epiphany of God in Christ, represented by Jesus as he passed by, they feared a demonic attack of some sort. Having followed him more or less faithfully in the preceding days, they had grown accustomed to the normal form of his presence among them, teaching and healing the people, but in their own situation of distress, they were unable to see his encouraging manifestation of the divine presence on their behalf.
Might we sometimes fail in theological imagination when we assume that people of other faiths or less privileged circumstances don't have anything to teach us? Like that person is, what if that person is Muslim? Or if that person is really poor and needs our help? So we're going to go there and teach them. And without the realization that maybe they can show God to us too.
Yeah. The next question here is, the disciples were fine, more or less, with ministry to others and leading them to Christ. But when it came to trusting for themselves, they experienced catastrophic failure. What about us? Here's a note. Thereby they pointed out how faithful followers of Jesus could be quick to mediate Jesus' healing presence to others while failing to receive it for themselves. The sea and storm is more than just a physical obstacle. It is a metaphorical obstacle that prevents the disciples from moving from zone of comfort to the unknown. What about us? A church that has been very comfortable in its cultural context is finding the culture around it radically shifting. The age of the culturally established Christian church is gone. The church is, again, sent by its Lord to cross over to the other side. There are adverse winds blowing against the church on this crossing, and the crossing is over the sea, the deep, in biblical language, the symbol of threatening chaos. In what ways might modern Christians' hearts be hardened? Remember, the Pharisees' hearts are also hardened. Mark describes that what the hardening is about. The Pharisees with hardened hearts are sure they know where the boundaries of the community of God's kingdom lie. In their case, with those keeping the law, particularly the law of the Sabbath. Can it be that the disciples' hearts are also hardened because they are so sure they know where the boundaries of the kingdom lie?
We can dispense for you, to you, the kingdom of God. We've got it. We've got it in hand, and we'll show you where it is. But don't try to change it. Don't try to change our perceptions of it.
Mark's narratives include literal parables, like the parable of the sower, but many of the stories can also be taken as parabolic. Now, some have described Jesus' parables as riddles, which makes sense in the context of the story. His parables were not intended solely to make an ethical point, though they sometimes did. Often, they were open-ended riddles that invited students inside the parable in order to delve more deeply into their own souls. Parables were portals that opened into a new level of religious consciousness. So in that sense, the feeding of the 5,000, the disciples in the storm, these are all parables.
They're stories of something that is presented as having literally happened, but they're also parables.
Because they don't necessarily have an ending. They're kind of open-ended. They invite the reader to enter in and to identify and to see what is my response.
Cool.
Here's a interesting statement. One might wonder which is more troubling, the presence of Jesus or his absence.
Oh.
Which was more troubling to the disciples?
Well, here the presence.
Yeah, here the presence was, you know, in modern Christianity thinks, you know, if only Jesus were here. Well, would we find that more comforting or more troubling?
Well, I'm sure a lot of modern Christians would find it really troubling because they'd see themselves smack dab in the seats of the Pharisees.
Right.
They would find themselves exactly in the situation of the goats, where they're walking up, to, you know, they're realizing that they did it all wrong the entire time, and they thought they were at the pinnacle of their religious consciousness the entire time. They might find themselves.
They might not like being told that anyway.
They might not like finding out that their job was,
We usually expect faithfulness to be found in the ones who are, you know, so-called spiritual or religious. But that is not necessarily the case. So here, already allusion has been made to the contrast between the disciples' slowness to trust the calming presence of God in their experience on the sea and the villagers' readiness to place the sick near Jesus. In this way, Mark reminds us that faithfulness is not always of the authorized sort. So even though these villagers had kind of a magical thinking about it, they did have some degree of faith, you know, in that they weren't scared off by Jesus as the disciples were in the storm.
And they had the idea of, we have a problem, here's a guy who can fix it.
Yeah.
The disciples have the idea of, we have a problem, and here's another one.
Well, see, but theirs was a deeper concern, though, because when you want to get what you want out of something and you see it's available, you can be faithful in saying, hey, I'm going to get that from that guy.
Right.
That's a shallow faith that only goes
but when you've lost hope. That.
But with the disciples, they're on that totally different end of it. With the fact that they're being put in a position where they have to, they're already beyond having their needs fulfilled. Their lives have been met.
Yeah.
They're safe and secure, and they were going out to do something, and then got chosen to do even more than they ever thought they were going to do. And so they're in a position they're constantly having to rethink their entire way of what they're doing.
While that is understandable, the disciples had walked with Jesus for quite a while. They themselves have gone out on their own to work miracles. And so, you know, maybe Mark's criticism of the disciples is somewhat justified, that, you know, they ought to have had faith.
Absolutely.
And, you know, the villagers, you know, really had only heard about Jesus and what... And so, you know, their kind of almost magical faith is adequate.
Yeah.
But that is even... That is more than what the disciples showed.
Right. But the disciples are also probably starting to get at that stage where their heads, they're teenagers now. Their heads are getting too big. Right? They're starting to feel like, okay, yeah, you can leave now, Mom and Dad.
Yeah, and so what
And then when they do, things explode and you say, oh no, we...
Yeah, what this commentator is maybe saying is that, you know, faith can be found in unexpected places.
Yeah.
And not found in where we would expect them.
Yeah, totally.
And finally, the type or degree of faith, not a person's future intent, nor a person's future intent, has no bearing on whether or not Jesus chooses to heal and minister to the people's needs. The only thing that matters is that Jesus has compassion for all who express their needs.
Mm-hmm.
So the commentary here notes, these people, they are not interested in following. They are interested in getting. Getting what they want, getting relief from their suffering, getting deliverance from their affliction. We do not know if those who sought Jesus out in Gennesaret for healing also intended to join his movement. We only know that they wanted something. This is what happens when the people all around sense there is a divine presence in their midst. Even if those whom the Son of God has called to be his community do not understand who he is. That he is an effective teacher and compassionate human being is beside the point. The plea is, what can you do for me now? By the end of the gospel, the crowd will have forgotten his good deeds and will turn against him.
Uh-huh.
Jesus responds because of compassion. The people don't care. All they want is, what can I get? But that's enough.
Well, and that...
And, you know, for humans, where we, you know, we are based on a transactional society all through history.
Uh-huh.
You know, we give for what you can give in return.
Uh-huh. But Jesus is not...
Yeah, Jesus' kingdom is totally foreign to that sort of concept.
Uh-huh. Yeah. He's totally introducing something completely new and they don't understand it. And he's just giving. He's just giving without any expectations.
You know, people take advantage of Jesus, and Jesus says, you know, that's okay.